Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. Today, the broadcast of our Talking Volumes season finale with Alexander McCall Smith. McCall Smith is what's known as a true polymath. He's written dozens of novels. He's a criminal law expert. He's a bioethicist. And our conversation was almost as wide-ranging as his career. We talked about the power of fiction, the idea of moral imagination, and, of course, the kilt he was wearing as he walked on stage at the Fitzgerald Theater. Is the kilt for us, or is it something you wear in many of your appearances?
Well, I do wear it quite often, not every day. You know, I don't get up every morning and put on a kilt, but I do wear it. In Scotland, actually, people wear the kilt for weddings, funerals, I'm sorry to say, and other occasions. Sometimes you'd wear a kilt. For example, at New Year or Hogmanay, if you're going to a dance or a party, you'd probably wear your kilt. And then you wear it on other occasions. But I find I quite enjoy wearing it when I'm on tour, because I think to dress up for big occasions, and, you know, Kerry, this is a terribly big occasion.
For us.
I've never had an invitation like this. This is really, seriously, I'm so excited. And so...
I can't tell if he's serious or kidding me.
No, I'm serious. So I thought I'd put my kilt on, and it's a very comfortable garment, in that you don't wear trousers, but getting into the kilt, you have a certain sort of routine. I put my shirt on first. I don't know if we need to go into this.
Go ahead. Oh, yes.
Because actually everybody is thinking, you know, I all know what people are thinking.
Right. Or,
I all know the question that they want to ask. And in fact, in some places, you do get that question.
I think you might tonight.
And I change the subject and say, but anyway, you put on your shirt. Then I tend to put on the socks and the shoes and the flashes, these things down there. And in fact, in Scotland, you put a knife but I don't do that in the United States, because that could be misinterpreted. And it's called a skin-do. And of course, calling a knife a skin-do is rather more friendly. I mean, yes. Skin-do's. And then you put the kilt round. Now, this kilt, actually, when I got it out of my suitcase at the beginning of this tour, I suddenly realised it had either expanded or I had shrunk. And normally, as one goes through life, kilts tend to shrink a bit. But in this case, so I'm suspended with various belts and whatnot, because I've been on a low-carb diet, Kerry, which I'd like to talk about.
Really?
My wife has said that I've become an 84-horsepower low-carb bore. And if you press the button, I talk about low carbs. Anyway, I won't talk about low carbs.
What is the... You have a little... what looks like a purse, but I know
yes.
It is... Yeah, what is that?
Well, this is called a sporran. And some people call it a purse. The other day, somebody said to me, "What is that flask?" And that's the first time I'd heard it described as a flask. It's a sporran. And this is the thing in which you keep your hand sanitizer.
Do you really put in there?
Not that in those days, when in the old days, you know, where people running around doing wonderful things in the Scottish mountains, they had hand sanitizer.
No, they did not.
Invented. But they realized that there would come a time when hand sanitizer would be invented.
Need.
So back in the 18th century, they thought at some stage people are going to invent hand sanitizer, and we need to have...
So this is how this will go. Okay.
It's going downhill pretty quickly.
I'm not going to ask you. I'm not going to ask you what's under the kilt, but I am curious about this.
Mm.
You have good legs, and...
Well, that's so kind of you to say that.
Does one have to have good legs to wear a kilt and these special socks?
Well, I think it probably helps. I mean, I've not really thought about my legs very much, and I wouldn't describe them as a good. I mean, they're adequate. They, in the sense that
they're
all,
strong and firm looking.
No, well, that's so.
This could be dangerous, couldn't it?
Really, this is really going downhill. I mean, I didn't think we were going quite that far.
No, this is exactly where this should be
going.
But
in fact, no, there is. I think it does help with kilts. I mean, some people shouldn't wear kilts. There's no doubt, but there are some people who shouldn't wear kilts. But on the other hand, as long as you're within the general range of human normality, in the sense, as long as you've got two legs, I mean. It's difficult. If you've got one leg, it's possible you should think of something else. But anyway.
Sure, go ahead with where you were going.
It's a very comfortable. The cloth is a very heavy wool. It's very thick and it's beautifully pleated. So a proper kilt, as opposed to, you know, an improper kilt, has a lot of pleats. It's an awful lot of material in it because it's very, very heavily pleated at the back. So it's a very heavy, heavy garment, and it's a great garment. And I like wearing it because, in a sense, it's dressing up in a way. And I think people do like. I think for special occasions, I think it's rather nice that we have things that we dress formally for. I feel that these days people have perhaps become rather too casual in what they wear. I know that comfort is all and should be fine.
Have you seen the audience tonight?
No. Well, they're all. I did see them. I went out before, and they were all beautifully dressed.
Yes.
Everybody was beautifully dressed.
Right. For you.
Yeah. No. And I think that's quite a. Quite a nice thing. I think that if, for example, I go to the dentist, I expect the dentist to be wearing a funny sort of blue outfit with buttons up the front.
Uh-huh.
And if you go and the dentist is wearing that, then you feel confident. You feel that this is exactly what dentists should wear.
Yes.
That this is set out in the plan for the world.
You're
the
confident
dentist. Yes.
When you see the dentist wearing his blue
dentist
scrubs.
Wearing his blue thing, that is absolutely as it should be. And I would be a little bit worried if the dentist were just wearing sort of dirty jeans. You know, you don't want to go to a dirty dentist. Dirty dentists really are not a good idea at all. In fact, you don't want to go to the dentist at all, but actually to a dirty dentist in particular. Managers should be wearing ties and appropriate trousers. You know, their trousers should have a certain sort of crease down them. And a bank manager whose trousers aren't creased, I think one would be a bit wary of.
The audience is saying, when's the interview going to start? How long are they going to do this? All right, I have a question for you, and you're the perfect person to help me with this. I got an email about a month ago from a listener who said, you talk about and evangelize about fiction and the value of fiction all the time. But I'm a big nonfiction reader, and I think in a world that feels chaotic and serious, we should all be reading more nonfiction, including me. She was taking me to task.
For reading too much fiction?
For reading too much fiction.
Oh, dear.
I started to compose an answer, and I thought, I've got the perfect person to talk to about this. Alexander is coming soon.
Right.
What would your answer be to that, given the fact that we do live in a world that feels unsettled and tumultuous.
Yes. And it is. I mean, we're living in very uncertain times.
Right.
And I think many of us feel that feel a bit adrift. Mm-hmm. And indeed, I suppose we are. I feel that there's a slight whiff of the 1930s at the moment.
How so?
Generally, well, I think that if you look at Western Europe, there's a sense of growing peril in that we're seeing people, I suppose, abandoning rationality and rational discussion of things in favour of irrational, mm-hmm. Emotive politics. And I think that's really rather worrying. And I'm not particularising it at all, and I certainly wouldn't presume to, certainly don't want to talk about your politics as an outsider. No, I think that's actually quite important that as an outsider to this country, I wouldn't presume to comment on your situation. I'm talking really mainly about Western Europe, and I think that in those circumstances, people are worried about the retreat from reason, mm-hmm. and the retreat from courteous discussion of things, which I think is terribly, terribly important, that we should be able to discuss issues of importance in a courteous way. We don't all agree about matters. I mean, that's patently obvious. We don't all agree, but we should continue to be able to talk to one another and to discuss issues in a rational way. And I think that what we're seeing is certainly, and here I'm talking principally about Western Europe, we're seeing a retreat into rather defensive positions where people exchange insults. And that, in my view, is very sad, because we shouldn't actually be exchanging insults. We should be saying, what are our issues? What are our problems? How can we somehow get through these and discuss them? And I'm not singling out any particular position for criticism there, because I think that it occurs on both sides of this debate. But I think that we must continue to believe in rational, courteous debate in which we allow the other person to say what they think about something. So, for example, when you get universities deplatforming people and saying, we don't want to hear from you, I think that actually is really very sinister.
And rescinding that, invitations to people who might have a view, yes, that the rest of the campus doesn't agree with or something.
Absolutely. Universities should not do that. And universities need to defend the principle of free speech. They need to defend that. Now, there will be people whose views are offensive, but actually they need to be heard, and then people need to say to them, we consider your views to be offensive. But you cannot actually silence people. You can't actually refuse to listen to people.
I mean, can you think of a better place for the exchange of ideas, offensive or not, than a college campus?
Well, universities actually have to remain open institutions,
right,
and they have to be open to all sorts of views, and that's healthy. And ultimately, one would hope that good sense will prevail, and that those who are on the real extremes on either side will be overcome by people whose views are humane and more sensible.
The good argument will prevail.
Yes, absolutely. And
okay.
I think you can't say to people, shut up. Because if you say to people, shut up, they don't shut up. I mean, this is really irritating. You hope they would shut up. In fact, in one of my Mara Matsui books, Mara Matsui says, you can't change people by shouting at them. And I think, actually, that really is quite true. You can't change people by shouting. It's terribly tempting to shout at people.
Yeah.
I mean, most of us, you know, think of the number of people we'd like to shout at.
Yes.
But actually, it's not a good idea.
All right. So back to this query that I have to answer with your help.
Yes.
Are we in a moment, given everything you've just described, when fiction does not reading fiction is not as important or urgent as...
Well, I think I would defend the position of fiction.
Excellent.
There, because... And so I would... Now, what I'm saying to you, Kerry, is that actually the person who attacked you in this sense, or criticised you in this sense, is wrong.
And, good. I knew it.
I mean, I'm sure you were just far too polite to say, look, you're wrong. But I think that if you look at what fiction does, fiction is the best way of developing the moral imagination. And the moral imagination is absolutely crucial. I don't know whether you have ever, I'm sure you have, you must have in your career on television and radio, you must have spoken to people where you have thought, this person has no moral imagination. Sometimes you find that, and somebody just, the person doesn't understand the position of the other, the pain of the other.
Yes.
And that is really quite an extraordinary feeling when you speak to somebody like that. They don't get it. They don't understand what it is to be the other person. And fiction is something which actually enables us to do that. And that's where children's books are so important, because children's books are the building blocks of the moral imagination. That's where we learn what it is to be the other person. That's where we learn what the other person thinks, what the other person feels. And it's children's books. And children's literature is terribly important. So if you've, as a child, if you've read books or had books read to you in which the feelings of other people, other characters, and it doesn't matter whether the other character is a rabbit or something of that sort, nonetheless, you understand it. Or a teddy bear. You actually understand what it is to be the other person, and you develop moral imagination. And if you've got moral imagination, thereafter in life, you will always be able to understand what the other person feels and how we must somehow negotiate with the feelings of the other person.
I mean, what you're talking about is...
Thank you.
Exercising, what I think of as exercising that empathy muscle in a place that allows you to do that, you know, without risk, right? With free range of the imagination.
Exactly. And fiction does exactly that. Now, I'm not saying that we should have a diet of unleavened fiction, because I think we should read other things. And indeed, probably, in my case, I probably read more non-fiction at the moment than fiction.
Really?
Yes.
Uh-oh.
I do. But that's
why?
Because... Well, that's because I think I've actually got to catch up in that I think that... In fact, I've got an awful lot of catch-up readings to do. It's really awful. I mean, I've got this massive... You must have. What? I shudder to think what your bedside table looks like.
Are you...
You know, big piles of books, you know, toppling down. I mean, there are some people like yourself, you know, critics and presenters and whatnot, who actually are injured by their books. Oh, I've known people. I mean, I visited friends in hospital.
What?
Because, oh, yes.
Where a nightside table just collapsed
their bedside, it's called the bedside table collapse syndrome.
I better check in
and
on
they, And they've got all these books, and it's a known industrial injury for people like you. And in fact, there's workmen's, there's compensation available.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Right. You can get... it's a recognized category of industrial injury. Collapse of large piles of books.
Yes.
And there are some... And I'm sorry to say, there have been some fatalities.
What are you catching up on? What I mean...
Catching up on... Well, I'm catching up on the 19th century novel. The 19th century...
No, but you're reading fiction then.
Oh, well, yes. Well, that's the fiction catching up department. So on this tour at the moment, I'm reading The Mill on the Floss, which I've never read before.
Are you?
Oh, it's terribly good. I've got page 78. And it's actually quite taunting because of about another 450 pages. But it's wonderful. I've been reading a bit of Trollope recently. And then I read all sorts of odd fiction, non-fiction. And my nonfiction is pretty eclectic. It depends what I see reviewed, enthusiasms of the time, things that I'd like to develop an understanding of,
right,
and so on. I tend not to read the various things. I don't read a great deal of biography. I read some biography, but not a great deal. A little bit of biography, and then all sorts of eclectic things. Occasionally I like something vaguely scientific or psychological. I've bought a book on Schadenfreude, which is in my case.
That's a fascinating idea, isn't it?
Interesting. Schadenfreude. Oh, Schadenfreude. You see, Schadenfreude is interesting because we don't have an English word for it.
Right.
There is no... And that's because that raises very interesting cultural, historical issues. Why is there no English word for Schadenfreude?
Because we all experience it.
We all experience... Oh, we do, to right, varying degrees.
Right.
I mean, I'm embarrassed when I experience Schadenfreude.
Yes.
It's the sort of thing we actually really don't want to experience.
Right.
But we do experience. It's rather like envy. Envy is another thing that we all experience. There's a whole school of psychiatric, psychoanalytical theory which says that envy is really, really important in our lives. And we feel a great deal of envy. I've got a book in my library of essays written from a psychoanalytical point of view about envy and saying how important envy is in our lives. Indeed, I did meet a psychiatrist many years ago who felt that envy was the most important issue in our lives.
Wow.
But he never used the word envy. He spelt it. He said E-N-V-Y. And that was very interesting and significant.
Because there was so much shame in
his... I don't know. I mean, I really don't know, but it was very significant. Whenever he wanted to mention envy, he didn't say it. He just said E-N-V-Y.
Wow.
And that actually, in our household, my wife and I, now we never refer to envy by its full name. We just say E-N-V-Y.
I think there's a difference. There is a difference between Schadenfreude and envy.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Yes. Envy is wanting to have what the other person has got.
Yes.
And that is... You know, that's pretty universal. Schadenfreude is real irritation that the other person has got it. That is really, really...
And wishing they didn't,
and wishing,
right?
And wishing they didn't, and then taking tremendous pleasure when they experience some setback. It's, you know, it really is terrific. And I suppose we all must admit to it. We all must. We
Are
love
you admitting
to
it?
Well, yes, but you know, subject to control. I would like to try and rise above it.
What inspires? No, we have to pursue this. What inspires? I mean, you've published how many books? You live this wonderful life. You travel the world. What could possibly inspire Schadenfreude in Alexander McCall Smith?
Well, I suppose I would look at when would I feel Schadenfreude? I suppose I don't feel a great deal of it. In fact, I won't say that I don't feel any of it, but I don't feel a great deal of it. I mean, I probably would feel it sometimes if there is somebody that I feel has really deserved disaster. And disaster occurs, and you think, well, there you are. I was right. So when somebody, something happens to somebody who you think has asked for it,
like Boris Johnson or
Boris, well,
who?
I'm not sure. I think if there's somebody who has irritated me greatly. And the relative, I have a very, very small enemies list. I was always.
But you do have a list.
Well, you know, I'm not sure if I do, because I was a great admirer of President Nixon, who was.
What?
because he was quite colourful, he had an enemies list.
Yes.
And I thought that was terribly funny. I thought that was so funny that you'd have an enemies list. And I don't really have an enemies list. I had a very, very small list of people who I wouldn't let into the house.
What have they done to deserve being denied entry to your house? What do you have to do to be turned away? Yeah.
Very extreme. I'd let virtually anybody into the house. But you have to really do something pretty awful to be denied entry into my house. I mean, most people, they knock on the door, I open the door, come in. But actually, one or two people, and it was a very, very small list. And interestingly enough, they have tended, both of them, because there are only two,
yeah,
have been rehabilitated. And so the enemy, the non-admission list, which is my equivalent of the enemies list, is now empty.
Did they rehabilitate themselves, or you just kind of went, fine? Well,
they made rather nice comments.
Oh, and they flattered you.
They flattered me.
Ah.
And if somebody says something rather nice, you say, well.
Strike off the enemies list.
But actually, I think it's a bad thing to have an enemies list. And I think what you need to do, if you have an enemies list, you actually need to have your enemies list in order to forgive them. Because I think forgiveness is really, really important. It's a very important virtue. And it's really difficult. Forgiving people is really, really difficult. I find it terribly hard.
Yes.
But actually, you do need to do it. Forgive people who have done something nasty to you, who have said something nasty to you. You actually need to say, I forgive you. And actually, this is one of the interesting things, being a writer. Occasionally, you get critics who say really horrible things about you. And what you need to do in those circumstances, when you read this horrible review, you say, I forgive you. And it actually makes you feel really warm inside. And you don't really forgive them, but nonetheless.
Oh, I see. Okay, before we leave the sins, though, because it's so interesting to hear you talk about the person you knew who thought, ENVY was the most interesting sin.
Terribly important.
What do you think the most interesting sin is?
Of the sins?
Of all the sins.
I'm not really terribly interested in sins. I think sins are fairly mundane. I think sins are quite banal. I'm much more interested in virtues. And I don't say that in any sort of pompous sense, but I much prefer to see kindness in operation, and I'd got far more admiration. Sins, well, anybody can sin. And I think the sins, or the vices, if we talk in non-theological terms, the vices are pretty mundane. Vices are two a penny. Anybody can be vicious in the old philosophical sense of the word. I don't find the vices particularly interesting. I don't. I'm not really particularly moved by people's indiscretions. I would take the view that a lot of the things that people do, actually, really, we should forgive. I take the view also that a lot of the things we do should be ignored, as long as we do them before we're 40, because. Because, you know, I know that's serious. I think, actually, most of the things you do before 40 should be forgotten about.
Really?
Oh, yes. And then...
Just wipe the slate off.
More or less. Because I think when you get to 40, you haven't got all that many excuses. Prior to 40, you're growing up. And I think after 40, then you need to act in a rather more adult fashion. But before 40, I think I take the view that teenagerdom goes from 13 to 40.
Wow.
And in fact, there's a school of psychology that says that males don't really grow up till 28.
Yes.
Yeah. And whereas women are designed to be much more morally developed at an earlier stage. So this, all the time saying about excusing, I wouldn't forgive women
This is where this was headed?
Yes, I'd say...
We're holding women more accountable?
Yes, until about 34. So I'd say that women can do all sorts of things but up to about 34, and then they need 35, maybe even 36. But actually, thereafter... so it's just a question of adjusting these responsibility indices to the rate of development. Because actually, if you look at girls of 16, 17, they're much more advanced than boys of 16, 17. Boys of 16, 17 are pretty crude. But girls are much better, much more sort of sensitive and receptive to
they're ahead with the moral imagination, right?
They are ahead with the moral imagination. Yeah. That's a fact, I think, of human psychology. See, there is this notion which is put about that we're all the same. We aren't. We really aren't all the same. There are differences in the way in which we develop in this world. And generally speaking, girls are more responsible at an earlier stage than boys. Teenage boys are wired neurologically in a way which makes them do silly things.
Did you say wild?
Wired. Yeah. Wired in their brains, the wiring, the neuronal
wired
connections. And they actually behave very irresponsibly. There was an article in the New Yorker about this, and I believe everything I read in the New Yorker. And it said teenage boys actually really just behave badly until sort of they get to 28. And and it's quite comforting, certainly for teenage boys.
Writer Alexander McCall Smith, the finale guest for Talking Volumes, the season of Talking Volumes. I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to NPR News and the season finale of Talking Volumes with author Alexander McCall Smith. Wow, what a storyteller. We talked about kilts and the power of fiction and free speech, and we covered a lot of ground, including how McCall Smith writes about the idea of sins and virtue.
I think virtues are intensely interesting. And I think it's an extraordinary mistake that we make to assume that we are only going to be interested in the pathological, that we're only going to be interested in things which are wrong, in confrontation and violence and whatnot. That's vaguely interesting. And, of course, I, like anybody else, enjoy a good, exciting, salty story. But I think, actually, that ordinary human nature and ordinary virtues, which most people have to some degree or other, are much more interesting, just much more interesting. I find kindness a wonderfully fascinating subject, fascinating. Violence is banal, mundane.
Well, then explain the popularity of endless numbers of crime shows and some of the most explicit crime novels, and I'm not sure if the public have caught up with your ideas about this.
I understand that there's a bit of a gap between my understanding of things and what happens to be the case, but nonetheless, I think that's because We've just allowed that to happen, and we have allowed ourselves to be entertained by the pathological and by the violent, and that we've come to accept it, and it's dulled and distorted our sensibilities, and that there's no reason why we shouldn't find the opposite of that intensely interesting. Look at the popularity of Jane Austen.
Mm-hmm.
We love Jane Austen. We absolutely love Jane Austen. And in Jane Austen, nothing happens. This is the whole point about Jane Austen. Absolutely,
it's so true.
Nothing happens. And that's what. And we like that.
I know.
We like
why?
Because that's what most of our lives are like. That most of us have lives in which nothing happens. I mean, really, nothing happens in my life. My life actually is one in which, really, I mean, I can't remember when last anything happened. And so we like it. And what are we interested in? We're interested in human issues, little arguments about nothing at all.
Yes.
Jane Austen said that her books were little squares of ivory in which she described these events or non-events. And that is exactly what we want. I love that. That's why in my books, effectively nothing happens. I really, really enjoy that. We're talking about ordinary human interactions, small-scale human interactions. We don't want great pyrotechnics in our life. We don't want explosions in our life. I mean, I don't know when I last heard an explosion. And I was in Sweden recently, Karen.
A lot of explosions.
Last year we went to Sweden, and I went there with an amateur orchestra, which I'm a member, called the Rally Terrible Orchestra, and we played in the great concert hall in Sweden. And I'm a great fan of Scandinavian noir.
Ah, yes.
Which is very, very noir.
And violent.
Well,
and plenty happens.
In a Scandinavian sort of way.
Yes.
You know. And I must say that I was rather taken aback because I was there in Stockholm for 3 days and I didn't see a single murder. Not a single murder. And I thought, am I in the right place? Have I been misled?
Right. I know those Scandinavians.
So I've invented a whole new genre of Scandinavian blanc. Not Scandinavian noir, Scandinavian blanc. And I've written a novel, and I've started a new series, which is going to be published next year, called The Department of Sensitive Crimes, all about a detective in Malmö who investigates crimes in which nothing very much happens.
Come on. Are you kidding me? Is this real?
Yes. No,
really?
I have. Yes. Yes. It's going to appear. The first book will appear in April under the title The Department of Sensitive Crimes. And it's all about the character I invented was Ulf Varg. Ulf means wolf in Danish, and Varg means wolf in Swedish. So he's Wolf Wolf. And there he is. He's a detective. He's a detective in Malmö.
Yes.
And
where a lot of bloody things happen, supposedly.
Tremendous murder.
I mean, look at Wallander.
Oh, I know.
Right.
I know. And anyway, all of these Scandinavian detectives have issues. So he's got his issues.
Yes.
He's got a hearing impaired dog and called Martin.
And, the trauma of it.
Martin is the only dog in Sweden who can lip read.
Is he kidding us or is this real?
Because I love writing about dogs. I've got Cyril in my 44 Scotland Street series. He's a wonderful dog. He's a Scottish dog. The only dog in Scotland with a gold tooth. And my Corduroy Mansion series, I've got Freddy de la Haye, who was a dog who was, he had rather a sort of checkered history. His first career was as a sniffer dog at London Airport, Heathrow Airport. And in fact, he was a victim of political correctness because they discovered that all the dogs at London Airport were male dogs. And therefore, as an act of sort of affirmative redistribution, they actually sacked half of the male dogs and put in female dogs. And a bad mistake, because thereafter, all the male dogs were only interested in the female dogs. And so they sort of sniffed. And the drugs flooded into the country. It was okay.
Oh my gosh. One of the things that you've done tonight and that I think you do in your novels is use humor really effectively to talk about some pretty, I mean, we've had a, yes, a wide-ranging conversation, but we've touched on a lot of pretty, you know, serious philosophical ideas.
Yes.
I think you do this so well in slipping humor into, leading us into some of the big questions that you're wrestling with and that your characters are wrestling with in these novels. And I'm just interested in how you developed that and how conscious that was. Was it there when you began?
Well, firstly, thank you very much for that. I think that you can write about the problems of this world, and the problems of this world are legion and overwhelming at times. And sometimes they're so burdensome and so distressing that we feel we can't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
I think that you can write about these things. You can write about ordinary day-to-day life and address those in a way which is maybe a little bit unexpected, but nonetheless in a humorous way, and get people to believe that, as I think most of us do believe, that in spite of everything, human nature has very positive aspects to it, and that we can deal with the challenges that we face, and we can deal with all the sorrows of this world. Because the world is a veil of tears. Whichever way you look at it, there are awful, awful things happening in the world. And one view is to say, oh, well, this is just too dreadful. What can we do? That's not the solution. What you need to do is you need to affirm those things which enable us to make something of the world and to deal with the world's problems. And so you can do that with humour, because humour actually really can say a lot about certain human qualities which are worthwhile. And so I don't think that it's impossible to write books that leave one feeling good about the world and at the same time not to be realistic about it.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can be realistic and you can fully understand the problems of this world, which are so awful. And yet at the same time, what's the point in just saying, oh, it's dreadful, we can do nothing? You can't do that. So you have to say, right, the things that we can celebrate. We can celebrate kindness. We can celebrate a positive approach to the world. We can celebrate fun, all of these things. So I feel I can defend my position. I'm accused of being a utopian novelist. People sort of say to me, oh, you're a utopian novelist, you're not writing about these grim matters. In fact, I am writing about very serious matters.
You are.
And I feel, though, it's a question of how we tackle them. And the only way in which we're going to tackle those is through keeping our sense of what is worthwhile and what is worth defending and what can see us through difficult times.
When critics write that about you, that you're traveling down a utopian kind of lane in this, that's a way of being dismissive about, I don't know, the seriousness of what you're writing or...
Yes, possibly. I mean, I think there's obviously, you can't please everybody, and there are going to be people who, whatever you write, there are going to be people who are dismissive. And I don't too much worry about that. I feel, I suppose, I don't ignore what they say, and I will look seriously at what they say, because I think you've got to be very, very sensitive to what people say about your work. And so I do take very seriously any criticism that anybody makes of me.
Why? At this point, you've sold
millions
of books. You're...
Yeah, but you can still... It still can really come home to you. Somebody can say something which you feel... somebody can say something hurtful, for example, And you could just dismiss it, but I don't like to do that. I like to address it. And I acknowledge that that not everybody is going to agree with my view of the world. But there we are. To a certain extent, actually, being an author and being therefore in public life, and you must understand this because you're in the same position, you're opening yourself up to criticism from all sorts of quarters. And one approach to that is to develop a very thick skin. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are some people who must have the thickness of skin of a rhinoceros. And they don't care what people say. But most of us, I think, actually are sensitive to what people say, and we would take it into account.
You have a poem that you have been sharing with audiences on this tour.
Mm.
This was an unexpected gift.
This poem arose because I spend a lot of time in airports. I was reflecting on the language used by pilots, and I thought, what would be the case if a pilot were to be a poet and have a poetic form of expression? And there and then, on the plane, I wrote a poem called The Language of Pilots, and it's a brief poem, but I like to read it. And this is how it goes. They speak with high authority, ailerons and wings responsive to their touch. Their words are functional too. But why, I wonder, should a pilot not be a poet too and say, we now descend at last through banks of cloud, white fields as wide as any ocean, at least when viewed from where we are a few moments ago or were. For it is Bernoulli's principle that keeps us here between the patient earth below and the empty soaring sky. Ladies and gentlemen, rain falls in distant vales. Look from your windows to the starboard side of this metal tube we call an aircraft. Look out there and see the rain, the grey-white shafts of rain. Do you know that those wisps of cloud you see up above are crystals of ice falling like gossamer? Did you know that? Now, please, about your waists, affix the belts, you must. As slowly towards the earth we drop to land's embrace, your belts adjust. We are a little late, but what are a few minutes, nothing more here and there? Not much, I think. Goodbye, and take with you the things you brought, your few possessions. Goodbye, until we meet again. And once again, we carry you on wings of steel, on wings of steel, to places you would wish to go. Goodbye, dear friends. It matters not whether you're a member of the loyalty scheme we've got.
Oh, my God.
We love you all as parents love their children equally. Remember that, and please come back. Goodbye again, and cabin crew, unbar the doors. Let light be seen. Secure what needs securing. Cross-check, whatever that might mean. Goodbye. Goodbye, goodbye. For soon these great engines will be silenced, as will I.
Wow. What a finale there for Talking Volumes with Alexandra McCall Smith. You can hear all of our Talking Volumes on the podcast, including the one I did with Sally Field. Just search NPR News with Carrie Miller, where you get your podcasts. So you cry sorrow, holding it off till tomorrow.
pain of centuries, years of history.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.